Sí, es un inglés. So. Got hiccups. Ajahn Sucitta was just visiting the monastery, which is always delightful. And he's doing a kind of compilation of reflections on Ajahn Sumedho's life, a sort of biography by interviewing the senior monks and nuns who. Lay people who knew Ajahn, who know Ajahn Sumedho. So that was quite fun doing that with him. And one of the things that we were reminded of was that Ajahn Sumedho quite often would take like 3 months and just go on one theme again and again and again in very creative ways and just kind of drive it home until it was second nature. So the theories or the ideas of Buddhism are an important structural background to the way we approach our spiritual life. If you don't have that kind of background, the way we interpret life is very often from a sense of self and wanting or from patterns that have come up in family life or cultural life, and so on and so forth. So if I was maybe raised in a family which was very racist and was very biased in that kind of a way, and then I'd see a person who was of that type that I'd feel racial discrimination, and my mind would just function from that habit. And I'd suffer, and I don't know. I think that was a kind of reality. And also, if I didn't have a good solid structure from which to consider my inner life, and I was just taking a kind of mishmash of ideas, a bit of psychology, a bit of mysticism, a bit of ayahuasca, a bit of this and a bit of that, they might be a whole array of inspiring ideas, but I might not really have a consistent sense of how to approach the inner world, the inner life, or even the outer life. And it could be very much hit and miss. So in modern culture, there are lots of popular ideas which are kind of quasi-Buddhist, but they're also quasi-this and quasi-that. So I'm speaking to this to some extent because there is a fellow that was experiencing some fear or something like that, and he was interpreting in a very sense, like he was saying, my ego is dying. I said, well, what does that mean? But that was just the ideas that he had incorporated into his mind, and that's what he put on top by the fear. So there was this interpretation from whatever. I go, what does that really mean? And he really couldn't answer it. So it was really a non-answer for him. And he'd been into Buddhism a while. I said, have you ever really looked at the Four Noble Truths? Have you really, really studied that? And then taken that on board as an approach to fear or suffering? And he said, kind of yes, kind of no. So for me, that central teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which Ajahn Sumedho just offered me day in and day out throughout the time in Thailand and at Chithurst and for his whole career, really, has formed in me and all of, I think, and Ajahn Chah too, their teaching has formed a kind of way of looking at life which is quite consistent And obviously it's in line with the Buddha's recommendations, his teachings, and it's the kind of go-to attitude when, all the time. It's what I go to when I observe, if I'm in a kind of contemplative mode. If I'm not in a contemplative mode, then I go to Paul Sellers and observe how to do woodwork with hand tools on YouTube. So that's another venue, which is fine. I recommend him highly. It's really nice. But Paul Sellers, that's not his, you know. His craft is wood, and the Buddhist craft is the heart, or liberation from suffering. So you all have your own backgrounds, but I would ask you to consider, do you really understand, intellectually at least, how Theravada Buddhism works? Do you kind of get the idea? Or do you sort of kind of know, kind of quasi sort of almost maybe? So let's say Thich Nhat Hanh's interbeing is not a Theravada idea. Now why? I don't want to critique Thich Nhat Hanh. It's a different kind of idea, right? Now, if you've really looked at Buddhism, you say, okay, that's a different kind of idea. Not that it's wrong. It has its place, but it's different than dependent origination. You look at it, you know what that's going on, and what that facilitates is a kind of critique of your own intellectual take on this, and then you pick up the tools which work for you, right? But if you don't have that, you can take up one idea, another idea, and Buddhism has these different ways of presentation, which they can all be good. They can all be good, but you can sometimes not have the kind of precision of attention, which I think a good basis of study is very helpful. Now, I don't present it that way. I probably used to, but I've been at it so long that I'm only interested in one thing, and that's what I hammer away at. But it is very helpful to go back to the Four Noble Truths and review that in your own mind so that you... first of all, to see, are you clear on all those terms? So you have the suffering, and what is suffering? So the Four Noble Truths, there's suffering, the cause, the end, and the path leading to the end of suffering. So what does the Buddha mean by suffering? Does it mean your leg gets cut off? Is it that kind of suffering? Right? Or that your stocks go down the tube and you don't have a pension fund? Is it that kind of suffering? No, it's much bigger than that. Broader than that. I mean, losing your pension is big. And I don't have a pension plan, but I do have a pension plan, actually. I'm doing all right. But the whole dukkha, the word dukkha is a very important word. And as I often say, this dukkha is used in three ways. So let's say, like for instance, we say there's suffering and the end of suffering, the cause of suffering, and then you really haven't contemplated what the word suffering means in the Theravada Buddhism. But if you really contemplate that word, what dukkha, what it means, it actually is presented in three ways. So there's dukkha vedana, and dukkha vedana is the feeling of unpleasantness in the sense realm. So if I'm sitting like this morning, this shin started to hurt. That's dukkha vedana. So it's unpleasant. But was the Buddha trying to liberate us from unpleasantness? Can't do, because I have a body. So his teaching on liberation, was it just to teach us that you can get to some kind of state where you're never going to have physical pain? Good luck. Is that what it's really about? So dukkha vedana is natural. It's natural to feel comfort and discomfort. It's natural to like a taste and dislike a taste. These, you know, these are natural things. Dukkha Satya, or the emphasis on the Four Noble Truths, is different, and this is that when we don't understand craving, when we don't understand desire, and we operate from that, we'll always get a skewed result. We'll always get a result which will be disappointing. Now that's not, and sometimes that gets sort of confused with Western moralities, which think that desire is wrong. That desire is not wrong; it's just natural. But what is the intelligent use of desire? Or, you know, what's the appropriate use of desire? How do you relate to it? So sometimes we can relate to like Buddhism teaching around desire in a very kind of guilt, evil, it's bad, sensuality is bad. But that's not what it's about, really. It's neither good nor bad, it's just natural. So understanding how craving operates and desire operates, and seeing the limits of it, then you can live in a desire world. It is a desire world, isn't it? Like if I didn't desire food, then I wouldn't eat. But the body needs food. If I didn't desire comfort, I would just hurt myself. So that's natural. And so the Four Noble Truths is just pointing to this sense that we as human beings feel discontent, we feel lack, we feel all manner of limitations in that way, and then we seek solutions to that, right? And that's what we do as human beings. If you're unhappy, you seek happiness. If you're in discomfort, you seek comfort. And if we didn't do that, you know, we wouldn't be human. So that's the natural thing we're doing. And the Buddha's taking that and saying, well, there are limits to this constant movement, but there is a place in consciousness which isn't dependent on that movement. So the way to resolve lack in one way is to rearrange the furniture. So we've rearranged the furniture here. We used to have it where I was at that end. And if you were at that end, I have to have binoculars to see you, right? So now we're really, it took us how many, 12 years to rearrange the furniture. Very good, we're slow, we're baby boomers. And so now we've arranged it that way. And we'll always do that, but if that was the only thing to do, then we'd be very frustrated because you always have to arrange things. So then the Buddha points to a third aspect of dukkha, and that's called dukkha lakkhana. That the characteristic of all sense experience is that it's unsatisfactory. And this really throws people off because it sounds like it's all dukkha. So which then sounds like it's all dukkha vedana, it's all painful, but it's not. Ice cream is not painful until you've eaten four tubs of it, right, or whatever. So you, if you conflate that like dukkha vedana with dukkha lakkhana, you get really confused. What kind of weird religion is that? Right? But dukkha lakkhana is just saying that the conditioned is not the unconditioned. That's all. You cannot find the unconditioned in a condition. And that's a whole different set of like ideas. It's a much kind of higher principle. So if you're looking for spiritual enlightenment in ice cream, you know it's stupid. But that doesn't mean you can't enjoy the ice cream. You just know that's not, you know, it's not the realm of it. But if you're curious about the unconditioned, right? You're curious about this the Buddha statement, there's the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unborn, the deathless, Nibbana. You're curious about his enlightenment. Or you yourself have had glimpses of some sense where the sense of self falls away and there's deep silence, what do they call them, epiphanies or something like that. Then that curiosity is very much enhanced or helped by the word of dukkha lakkhana, the idea of dukkha lakkhana, that in no conditioned thing will you find the unconditioned. You won't find fulfillment on that spiritual level in the conditioned realm, in an emotion, in a relationship, in the body, in a meditation retreat. In a ham sandwich or a tofu sandwich, whatever you like. So then your perspective then in investigation is one of non-grasping the conditioned. Then you begin to understand what non-grasping is about. It's not rejection. It's not saying that these things are wrong. It's just that if I'm always going out to objects, then I'm always in the conditioned and I'm not available to the unconditioned, whatever that might be. I'm not available. How can I be available if I'm always caught up in analyzing my emotions or caught up in projects or caught up in fears and desires and so on? So dukkha lakkhana is just saying that there is the conditioned and there's the unconditioned. So anything that arises and ceases is unsatisfactory. Right? So and this is where you get this strange paradox, is that happiness is unsatisfactory. That the characteristic of happiness is dukkha, dukkha lakkhana. But it's not unpleasant. Can you get that, right? It's not unpleasant, but we all know that it will change. Which doesn't mean then we live in a, okay, I'm not going to have any happiness now because it's going to change. You can't do that. It's impossible. Because happiness will come. I'm sorry. Hate to disappoint you. I just, you know, so you try to stay miserable constantly. It's actually quite hard, I guess. I mean, some people seem to be able to do it. And usually it is because of some deep psychological trauma. Yeah, it's cruel of me actually to make jokes like that. But I'm just pointing to the fact that sometimes we don't see the kind of, like, where this teaching is coming from. That the teaching around, you know, when we say that the world is unsatisfactory, that sounds terribly annihilationist, doesn't it? It's like, you know, the like that cartoon I once saw where the guy's sitting in a toilet, goodbye, cruel world, and flushes the toilet and goes down. It's all bad. It's not that. It's not that at all. There is beauty, and there is a place for beauty and culture and so on. But can beauty and culture and all the rest of it be a support for the realization of the unconditioned as opposed to an end in itself? And that's what I would, yes, for sure. So can chanting be a support to calming the mind, to abiding in the silence of knowing? Can iconography be a way of bringing us back to a center of being, which isn't dependent on objects? Yes, yeah, we can use all of that. So we can use culture. Can friendships and relationships be helpful? Yeah, for sure. But friendships and relationships are unsatisfactory. Their characteristic is that they're not reliable. And that doesn't mean that all our friendships are like cheating friendships. That's not it either. It's just that friends die. A terrible thing, and they do that, and I die. And dogs die. People get very, very close to their dogs. And that's understandable because they're beautiful beings. And then the dog dies, which doesn't say, well, I'm never going to have another dog again. No, you just realize, oh, yeah, that life is that way. That which has a nature to arise is a nature to cease. And as you contemplate that, then with loss or disappointment or death, or all these things that we experience as human beings, you say, oh yeah, that was supposed to change. It was supposed to die. That was supposed to end. That's its nature. That's its characteristic. Its characteristic, its lakkhana, is change. So not only do you have the lakkhana of, or the characteristic of dukkha, you have the characteristic of change. And because it's changing, because it was born, because it dies, you have the characteristic of dukkha. And they're correlated. And also that, oddly enough, it's not personal. Right? That the nature is not personal. Right? The trees are born and die. The seasons change. It's not your fault. Winter is your fault. Right? The polar vortex is someone's fault. But it's not, it's just natural. It's just very, very natural. So these characteristics, and that's when we talk about events and all of that. What we talk about in Buddhism, in when we're talking about characteristic, is that these are dependently originated. It depends. So rather than talking about a self, that I am someone who has problems, we talk more that with this as condition, that arises. When there is this, there is that. With loss as condition, there is grief. That's natural. With success as condition, there's some kind of happiness. These things arise and cease dependent on causes and conditions, arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing. And that's what we use instead of like words like ego or self. We don't really have that language in Buddhism. I use the word ego sometimes or that, but what the Buddha uses is this very, what we call dependent origination. That the like I was thinking of a story, and one of those early stories when I came to Toronto, because we were talking with Ajahn Sucitto about early days at Chitters and so on, but when Ajahn Anando and I came to Buffalo and Toronto in 1977, we were staying with my parents in Toronto, and we would go out on alms round every day near Bloor and Jane, 1977. So here are these two brown-robed guys walking along with bowls, and we got so much abuse. People would yell at us, and we got spit on, and all kinds of really lovely things. And I thought, there's a bunch of barbarians in this town. And just talking about dependent origination, okay, dependent on insult is a feeling of, ooh, I don't want to go outside. And you could say, oh, Viradhamma, you shouldn't feel that way. It's just your ego. Not really. It's just my nervous system. This is what nerves do when they're attacked. You feel fear. You know, we didn't want to go outside. But we were young and adventurous, so we went out. And then one day we were walking along my mom's street, Mayfield. And there's some guys clearing the rubbish bins. And they're on the trucks, and you know, as soon as we see them, okay, here we go. Get the abuse. And they say, good morning. Someone loves me. And that was a good feeling. Now, it's dependently originated. It depends. You know, it just depends. With insult as condition, you get this kind of condition. With insult as cause, say. And with kindness as cause, you get this kind of thing. It's dependently originated. All right? But what is not dependently originated? And then that's the knowing, the awareness, which was always there. I knew that I felt, this is the land of barbarians. I don't want to go back to Thailand. And I knew, I felt, oh, gosh, these guys are lovely. I think it's not a bad town. I knew that. I knew I could be aware of that. And that's the thing that endured. Right? That's the thing that endured. So the three characteristics, and this is when we talk about this word anatta, not self. It's a very difficult word. Because it's only used in the context of flow of consciousness. It's not used in the context of social responsibility. And this is very important. So, Venerable Amarsira and I live under a rule called the Bhikkhu Vinaya. And that rule governs our behavior and our relationship and our speech and our sharing of requisites and so many other things. I can't say to Venerable Amarsiri, let's say I decide that, well, let's, you know, we'll just go to the kitchen and grab a sandwich this afternoon. No one will know. And he'll say to me, but that's, we don't, that the rule says. He said, well, it's not self. Don't worry about it. It's not self. It does, no. You know, I am a bhikkhu and I have these responsibilities and rules, right? So that's where we use a sense of self as in a social context. But also, as we watch the flow of consciousness, we can see that the emotions and feelings and all of that arise according to causes and conditions. We can see that. And so it's a paradox. There is a You know, there is a sense of me being a responsible person, but there's also this flow. And I look at that, I can't find a fixed me. I can see, awareness is there, sure, consciousness is there. But when I try to find a fixed thing called Viradhammo, I don't know about you, where'd it go? It's gone, and there's just emptiness. There's just silence when I look for it. Okay, who am I? Me. Huh? Mind goes silent. So it's a kind of a paradox, and we use both. We use both. So if you use dependent origination, then you see you have these three characteristics there. That which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease, anicca. Because it's dependently originated, there's no fixed entity in that. And because it's changing and unreliable, it has the characteristics of being unsatisfactory in relationship to that which is satisfactory. And that's the unconditioned, or nibbana, or enlightenment, or freedom. All right? So I don't know if you understood all that, but you could see, if you haven't got that one down, if you don't really kind of get it, why you have anicca, dukkha, anatta, you could take anatta as some kind of annihilationist theory, I can rob a bank, it's not self, or I don't know, some kind of wacky thing like that. Or you could take dukkha lakkhana and think, well, boy, Buddhism's really negative. It's really, really so, so negative. And misinterpret where this is all coming from. Right? So it's quite important to sort of get those fundamental. And I don't know even if I explained it well, but it's worthy of study. It's worthy of study. And these three characteristics are quite crucial in the way then we interpret the flow of consciousness. So what we're trying to see in flow of consciousness is the three characteristics. And if we do that, each time we do that, any of the three, we tend to come back to awareness. When we are interpreting the flow of characteristics, the flow of conditions through desire, then we're in that flow. Fair enough, you use that. So if I'm hungry and I want to eat some food, I eat some food. So I'm interpreting through desire, wanting, and so on. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's limited. It's limited. So if my project is to be the perfect personality and never have any negative emotions, I think that's impossible. Well, so far. I'll tell you more next year. But if I'm interpreting life through a dependent origination, change, and unsatisfactoriness, and I see a negative emotion arise, and I say that with this as condition, this as cause, this arises, and it's changing, and there is the space of knowing, then that whole package is freedom. It's already freedom. But if my idea of Buddhism is that, or life is that somehow that negative emotions are somehow wrong or shouldn't be there, then what do? I tend to just get preoccupied with them through a kind of inner argument. So I feel negative towards someone, and then I reinforce that and look at, and then I feel negative towards myself, I shouldn't be like that, and then, oh, but they're an idiot anyway, they deserve it, but yeah, well, what am I going to talk to them next week? I'm going to have that meeting, and then, yeah, but I don't know what I'm going to do, and then I hit the bottle, I suppose. I don't know what I do. But that's all just preoccupation, isn't it? It's just going on and on, ad nauseum. But if the interpretation comes, oh, with this as condition, that arises. When there's this, there's that. This being, that comes to be. I see that, and there's the knowing, and this is changing, and don't grasp it, and don't get preoccupied. Ah, okay. You get a sense that even within the most horrible mind state is not you. You are not your personality. Now, one of the really interesting things is that you can notice, there can be awareness of personality, can't there? And you can be very, very charming with one person, because you're in a charming mood and they're charming or whatever, and charms on the plate for the day or whatever. And then you can feel like really rotten, have the flu and have a bad headache and be absolutely crappy to another person the next day. And you can know that. You can know personality coming and going, can't you? So is that your real home? No. I would say no. Your real home is knowing, awareness. And awareness is not a self, is it? It's not like a me. It's just consciousness, presence. That's why it's so ineffable. It's not so ineffable. Now, to do this kind of awareness practice, you need a good lifestyle, right? You need good friends. You need good support. So that's like monasticism is incredibly good support for falling apart. It is incredibly good support for really being no one going nowhere, as we said. Very, very helpful. If you don't have support, or you have a lot of, let's say, damage from childhood or whatever, it's very hard to do. Very hard to do, kind of thing. So these three characteristics are to me very important, but also they are in conjunction with the Buddha's teaching on the unconditioned. They have to go together. If you take them out of that context, it can be quite confusing. So on this retreat, again and again, I'll just emphasize the awake mind, if I may. Not that you have a choice. And just trying to, you know, point to various ways of just awakening. So if like I was saying earlier, these two ideas I use a lot. I say that this experience of me talking, you listening, there's a sense of me and you. So I can see faces, I can see gender, I can see a color, and so on. And that's true. Without denying that, it's also for me true that this whole experience is in consciousness or in awareness. Now, I usually we think consciousness is somehow behind the eyeballs, in your brain, right? But I don't know about you, the brain to me seems to be in awareness. And the scientists would disagree with me probably. They say, yeah, once the gray matter goes, that's it. Great dark hole of whatever. Buddhism would disagree. Consciousness is not a physical element. So that's a good one. What do you reckon? Is consciousness gray matter? Or is gray matter in consciousness? You can't prove it either way. Right? So rather than try to prove that, why not just take that perception as a working hypothesis? Not a belief, but actually a practice. Try that. So if you think that this is a load of bunk, okay. A load of bunk, where is that? That's in awareness. That viewpoint of thinking, or if you don't understand what I'm talking about, you know, that very feeling of not understanding what I'm talking about is in awareness. So I would suggest using that perception, not believing in it. And that's different. You know, like using a perception is something you make conscious as opposed to, well, yeah, maybe. But actually using it, you have to do it. Yeah, see what I mean? So as you start to, whatever experience you have, can you do that? This is in awareness. And hold that space. See what happens. And try to do it kind of every 10 seconds. Do it a lot. Do it a lot. This is in awareness. Try to do that a lot. So I was doing fruit salad in awareness. Very interesting, I tell you. So there was cantaloupe, grape, my blueberries. Maybe I don't think there was banana. Maybe it was banana. So I tasted cantaloupe. This is this way. Cantaloupe tastes this way. And then I tasted blueberry. Blueberry tastes this way. And what's changing? And then that's what's unchanging. So I spent the whole fruit salad practicing this is in awareness. Very calming. And it was a good fruit salad. But, you know, that's the kind of practice I suggest, that you're kind of doing this all the time. Because, you know, when we eat, we kind of, oh, this is great. And then already we're thinking, well, I really want a pizza. So, oh, you taste it for 30 seconds at the most, and you're gone. Now, and this is different than sensual indulgence. You know, I'm not trying to get as much happiness from that grape as possible. I'm not trying to milk that grape for maximum happiness. No, it's just grape feels this way. Cantaloupe feels this way. I know it sounds very mundane, but it's a very strong change in taste. You know, the change from a grape to a blueberry is quite a strong change in taste. And if you notice that change, And then you say, what's unchanging? Oh yeah, there it is. There's the silence of the mind, peace of the mind. I don't know if it works for oatmeal. Probably doesn't work for oatmeal. Try something else. Okay, I've talked a bit too long, so please stretch your legs and we'll do some sitting.